welcome to Engaging Science, Technology, and Society, the open access journal of 4S, the Society for Social Studies of Science. I'm Grant Otsky. I'm associate editor of the journal. What follows is an interview with Professor Sharon Trawick of the University of California, Los Angeles. She's recipient of the Society's Bernal Prize in 2020. In this interview, Professor Trawick discusses her research, her academic career, the many influences on her life, and her thoughts on SDS in the past and future. The interview was conducted on Zoom on April 23, 2021, by Professor Kim Fortune of the University of California at Irvine and Professor Duygu Kaştoğan of İzmir Katip Çelebi University. The recording is provided without edits. This interview and an edited transcript appear in Volume 7 of Engaging Science, Technology, and Society as Searching for How Epistemic Power is Made, Appropriated, Circulated, and Challenged, an interview with 2020 Bernal Prize winner Sharon Trawick.
Hello, we're here for an interview with Professor Sharon Trawick, the 2020 winner of the Society for Social Studies of Science Bernal Prize for career-spanning contributions to STS. We'll talk to her today to draw out the intellectual genealogies that she was educated, has transformed and continues to work within, and that she shared with a whole generation of STS scholars. Our first question, Sharon, is tell us how you got into historical and social studies of science. What led you to this work? What were the challenges? How did it matter that you entered it at a particular historical juncture in a particular setting?
Thank you. Very briefly, I'll say something about the first years. I grew up in a turbulent family. Both my parents had migrated from California, one from Oklahoma and one from Texas, during the later stages of the American Depression. And I spent some of my childhood in Oklahoma and Texas and Arizona, as well as California. And my extended family includes people from a lot of different kinds of backgrounds related to the southern half of the United States. So mostly I grew up in El Segundo, a town in Southern California that is now just south of the Los Angeles airport and just north of the refinery now owned by Chevron and just east of a Hyperion sewage treatment plant. When I say just, I mean a few blocks from each of those. So it was, I grew up very near some toxic sites. The school system happened to be rather good because of the American taxation system and schooling, is that all those corporations contributed a lot. And in those days, it was pre-Reagan, pre-neoliberalism, pre-information-based political economy, and the idea of having workers have good schools and so forth was still alive and well. So I grew up in a toxic waste site with very good schools and in a turbulent family, and it was very near the beach, so we just needed to walk over the sand dunes to get to the beach. And often at those sand dunes, I would see the film companies doing those 1950s movies of what I'd now call West Asia and North Africa. So we would linger there and then go on to the beach, where we would do, in those days, girls did body surfing and boys did board surfing. And so we would often go to the beach before school and after school, and often instead of school. And at school, I became very interested in mathematics and music. Ended up taking music theory. The senior math teacher just lived down the block from where I lived, and he had five daughters. So I never got the impression in school that math was just for boys. And the other math teacher in the school, Mrs. Tafoya, was quite beautiful, and she was considered the most beautiful teacher in the school. So again, I never got the impression that math was just for certain kinds of girls even. And I was encouraged to go to college. I was the first in my family that I knew of at the time to go to college. And my mother was in favor of it. My father wasn't. He very much thought that it was a bad idea for girls to go to school too much. And from a lot of 19th century points of view, I later realized. And my mother, nonetheless, who had, my father's father was illiterate. My mother had not finished high school. Why was my mother so interested in school? She saw it as prestige. She saw it as opportunity. She was very ambitious. She remained the most ambitious person I ever met. And when the teachers started talking about me going to Berkeley, she was very pleased. So she decided to take a job. When my father opposed the very idea of this, she decided to take a job. And she got a job as a telephone operator. And for those of you who don't know, maybe you've seen some old movies where a call comes in and an operator plugs cords in two places. That's what she did at the refinery. And she encouraged me to go to Berkeley, and I did. And when I got there, I thought I would be a math and music major because that's what I knew. But I also took history and philosophy classes. And my roommate my first year turned out to be what in US is called a red diaper baby. Her father had fought in the Spanish Civil War. She comes from a very, very literate family. One of her grandfathers had gotten a Pulitzer Prize for his poetry. And her father had a lot of trouble from the House on American Activities Committee, which I'll say more about in a minute. And we were astounded by each other. She thought that everybody had to go to college. And I told her it was an option. She got furious because she didn't want to go to college. So after we had that long conversation, we went over to the library. We were sitting at the library when it opened the next morning. And we got in there and we asked to see the almanac, talked with the librarian, where's the law that says you have to go to college? And he said, well, there isn't any such law. Well, my roommate was, the red diaper baby was furious. And we went to see her parents who were in San Francisco in a lovely place. And she, forever after that, her family blamed me for she dropped out of college. She later returned. But anyway, we astounded each other. And I knew how to do the fashionable hairdos of the time, and she didn't, so I taught her. We were a major confusion to each other. We're still friends. Through her, I learned a lot about politics. I had already, through my mother, had a strong proclivity toward supporting, thinking that poor people were likely to get the short end of the stick. And I had gotten a lot of messages like that while I was growing up from my mother. So there I was at Berkeley, and this is I started in 59, and there were a lot of people in Berkeley from Hungary, from the revolutions from 1956. And I met them at a coffee house, which I didn't know about any of these kinds of places, but my roommate was introducing me. And also I learned about the nuclear disarmament movement, which I became active. And also through my roommate, I'm not saying her name just for her privacy's sake, I learned about the various political groups on campus. And there was one called SLATE. There was something that we just referred to as YPSL. That's the acronym for Young People's Socialist League. And the Progressive Labor Party and some others. And it's in that context that I learned that everybody was anti-Stalin. Some people were pro-Trotsky and some people were anti-Trotsky. Some people were pro-Mao and some people were anti-Mao. And that it was important to become informed and know your position on all of this in this world that I very quickly entered, and was marching then with nuclear disarmament, the House on American Activities Committee demonstrations in San Francisco, both in 1960, learning about the South African apartheid world and Mariam Makeba's position in it. And then at the same time, I was taking my math classes and my music classes and learning a lot that I hadn't known before. And by the time I was in my junior year, I was taking a class in both math logic and philosophical logic. And I thought the teachers were contradicting themselves, and I was very deeply confusing to me, and I went to talk with each of them, and they each told me to drop the other's class. This was quite shocking to me. Going to the beach so much, learning to body surf, we had spent so much time looking at the waves on the beach, and I realized how mathematical that was, and I knew that the musical theory was mathematical. And in my turbulent childhood, the mathematics, all these patterns, these beautiful patterns were a deep, serious comfort to me. And so whenever I thought about math, I thought about the music and I thought about the waves. And I thought of everything else being turbulent except this aesthetic world, this comforting aesthetic, very embodied world of mathematics and music. And I was profoundly troubled by this contradiction. And I quit school. And I went to New York City and got a job as a statistics assistant at an oil company. And I was living with same apartment with my my roommate from college who had dropped out. And I took a course at the New School for Social Research at night. And the teacher there, I just wanted something that was completely different. And I took a history of the Mongols in Central Asia and their movement from Mongolia through Turkey and into Eastern Europe. And the teacher of that class said that in order to understand what happened, I would need to look at records in multiple languages because each language in each time period would be framed differently by the scholars who were in different worlds in each of those time periods in different languages. And I began to think, oh, there is a way to make sense of all this turbulence. And this teacher asked me what languages I knew. And I said, well, English is first language. I've studied French and I have this background of probably meaningless in Spanish. It's just completely oral. And the teacher said, well, that's not enough, but I'll help you. And then he said, you have to go to the New York Public Library and you have to go see such and such teachers, I mean, such and such librarians and such places where they have the records of this and so, and they'll tell me how you're doing and I will supplement what you don't know and they will help too. So I was introduced to this idea of a kind of scholarly community. I thought it was amazing. It was really quite weird to me. So I spent my weekends there at the New York Public Library in one of those little rooms where they had books all the way to the ceilings, tall ceilings with those little stairwells that I thought only existed in movies. And so I got excited by that, but I was also very much involved in all of these political debates. And so I'm going to elide stuff here and just sort of jump forward. I decided to return to school, but I wasn't sure where. And I reapplied to Berkeley, and I also applied to University of Mexico in Mexico City, UNAM, the National University of Mexico. And I didn't hear back from UNAM, that was my first choice. And I did hear back from Berkeley, so I accepted it. And after I was at Berkeley, I got the acceptance from UNAM. I partly interested in UNAM just because of all of the politics and the liberation movements. It was very exciting at the time. And then also part of my family background. And this part of the United States, you know, has been indigenous people. It's also settled by the Russians and the Spanish and the Mexicans before the Americans. So my family has been part of lots of that. And so I was very, very interested, but I went back to Berkeley and continued to be involved in a lot of this politics. And there was a period in the 60s in which the early writings of Marx became very much available in English and were part of a huge debate. And I was taking political theory class with Louis B. Feuer, who was one of the, that's F-E-U-E-R, was teaching all of this. And I was in a circle of people very much engaged in these issues. There were also some of the early concerns about the Vietnam War, Madame Nu came to Berkeley and gave a talk that I went to. Dolores Huerta was giving a talk at Berkeley in those early 60s years about the new farm workers movement, and various civil rights activities were going on, including a big march on against the on Van Ness in San Francisco about the automobile companies, the sales places not hiring Black workers. So that brings me up to 64, but it really situates my concerns in a very lively, active political debate. And I want to say too that from the civil rights movement, Stokely Carmichael is marrying Marian Makiba from the apartheid movement. And he's also saying, when people interview him, what position is there for women in the movement? Famously, he said this in 1964, that the only position for women in the movement is prone. And he and Makiba divorced. But it was, I was very much in a world of all these political debates, plus some very powerful, influential women, and also a very gendered world. And in the debates about Marx's early writings, there was the whole Louis Althusser debates. So the whole sort of idealist-materialist dichotomy seemed much more complex in the earlier writings, including in Althusser's work, in which the ideas and the culture was not necessarily derived only from the economic, but that they were much more intimately connected. And this difference of interpretation was volatile during most of my 20s and 30s. So I just wanted to clarify all that background and then say that it's in that context that so this is going to take about two more minutes. After I graduated from Berkeley, I went to New York City, and I had planned, given my understanding of political economy, I decided I wanted to be a research analyst for a Wall Street firm and learn much more about the flow of capital. And I went to have such an interview, and they told me that there was a mistake about me getting the interview because only men were hired for those positions. And I said that a few weeks earlier that the Equal Rights Amendment had passed and that it included women, and that perhaps they wanted to reconsider this summer of 1964. And the guy said, excuse me, and left, and he was gone for a long time. And when he came back, they offered me the job. And I said I wanted to start the following month because I wanted to take a break, find an apartment, and so forth. And in the midst of that time, I thought, I'm great. I'm going to figure out all this. And then I began to think about what I wanted to do with my life and so forth. And it's a long story, but I called up my advisor at Berkeley, my senior advisor, and told him I had belatedly begun thinking about graduate school. It was a very different time before all the metrics and the evaluations and the transparencies and so forth. And he said, well, it's a bit late to get you into Berkeley, Sharon, but why don't you go to San Francisco State, get a master's degree, and I'll get you back in here to Berkeley for your PhD. And I said, okay. He said, you should go study with Vartan Gregorian, who's not quite finished with his dissertation from Stanford, but he's very smart. You work with him. I'll call him up. Well, within a few weeks, I was a graduate student at San Francisco State with Vartan Gregorian, who was also the advisor to the Student Progressive Labor Party. And we got along just great. And it was a lively time. I was there 64 to 66, which maybe you know in San Francisco was a rather interesting time to be in San Francisco. And I had a great time. And now there is a bit of a lurch. I'm going to come back to Vartan in a minute. He advised me to go after the master's degree, instead of going to Berkeley, to go to New York, NYU, because a faculty member there he thought I would work well with. And I applied there and I was admitted. But in 66, got a detour. I got married. I came back to California, got married in New York, but came back to California and began living in La Honda, where the Merry Pranksters, Ken Kesey and all that were also in La Honda. And my husband was a graduate student at Stanford. And I did lots of different things, worked mostly as a teacher. I had worked in New York as a teacher in the Upward Bound program with kids in Harlem, Spanish Harlem mostly. And also back in California as a tutor and also as a substitute teacher, mostly in disadvantaged schools, but also a tutor at a very privileged school. And my husband got a grant to do his archival research in Europe, and we arrived in Paris in August 1968. And where the political discussions, my husband had been a student leader at Stanford, and so all sorts of demonstrations and stuff, which we continued participating in all that in Europe. And in 71, we separated, and I moved back to the peninsula, the Bay Area, and I got very much involved in the Mid-Peninsula Free University, and lots has been written about that. I won't go into that right now. I joined a commune, became very active in a whole network of communes throughout the Bay Area and up the West Coast into Oregon and Washington and also to Virginia. And I started working at SLAC, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. So through all of that, the historical political context of knowledge making, Althusser, Marx's early writings, to my own embodied career as a student, I had become very much engaged in what is the history of knowledge making and the socio-political conditions under which it was conducted, and was very committed to studying that. And I thought that philosophy of science was the right way to go, and that's what I was studying at Mid-Peninsula Free University. And the work that I was studying very much led me to then be very receptive to reading Tom Kuhn's work, first published in 64, 65, and I was working at SLAC and decided that that was what I would study. I was also in a political action group with some of the people at SLAC I was working with, which some included some with the Science for the People movement. And they encouraged me, some anti-war physicists, and they encouraged me in my ideas about going back to school. And they wrote me letters of recommendation. And I applied to Berkeley and to Santa Cruz. And I was admitted to both. And when I went to Berkeley to talk with them, I learned that they had planned a big project to do contemporary histories, as it's called, of major laboratories in the Bay Area. And they had not yet formed a connection with SLAC. And then my application came over the transom with letters of recommendation from physicists. Plus I had, with the recommendation of the physicists, also gotten a fellowship that would finance my whole undergraduate, my whole graduate student career. So I didn't realize that I was a kind of walking gift to them, but I realized they were being very nice to me, and I was a bit surprised how nice they were all the time. And finally they said, where else have you applied? And I said, Santa Cruz, History of Consciousness program. And there was a long silence. And then one of them later became a very prominent person, provost at Berkeley and so on, said, young lady, I was in my mid 30s and did not like being called a young lady for any reason whatsoever, said, young lady, have you noticed that there's a bus that comes every day, goes every day between Berkeley and Santa Cruz? And I said, yes. And he said, have you noticed which direction it goes? And I said, you mean it goes from Santa Cruz to come to the library at Berkeley and spend the day at Berkeley's library and then goes back? And he said, absolutely, let that guide your decision. So I did. When I went to Santa Cruz and I met somebody who, I just picked the first person on the list, didn't know who it was, and first history of consciousness. And I was a little taken aback when his shirt wasn't fully buttoned and he was not wearing socks with his shoes. It was Gregory Bateson. And he asked me all sorts of interesting questions. And one of them was, I said to him, there were at least three different versions of the past. I could tell it at the lab. And what did he think of that? And I'd asked the same question at Berkeley, and they had said, we'll help you figure out the correct version. And this guy at Santa Cruz said, well, they must have three different versions of the future. And I thought, he's right. And I said, you have ways of exploring this idea. And he said, well, yes, that's anthropology. So I went to Santa Cruz. And I said, I want to study the physicists. And so I need to study philosophy from the Free University. I had decided I needed to study history. And sociology, I thought, was the answer. And philosophy, history, and sociology. And I needed to have physicists on my advisory committee. And they said, sure. And at Berkeley, they had said, well, perhaps. And the ISTCON program was run as a collective at the time, and I was in a commune, and the reason I did not apply for any place outside the Bay Area is because I had no intention of leaving the commune. It was too important to me. So that's how I ended up at Santa Cruz and why I thought Santa Cruz was the right place for me. My friends who were professors and already academics all said this was a terrible decision, because if I were going to take the trouble to go back to school, which was a huge aggravation, but necessary for certain kinds of careers, I should at least go to the place that had where my degree would have my higher status. And I decided that what I wanted to do did not involve people being impressed by Berkeley. Quite possibly as stupid as my advisors were telling me, but on the other hand, the physicists were telling me, just get a PhD and come back here to the lab and help us revise some of these things. Okay. And at Santa Cruz, the other students were all saying, we're not in this because we want to become an academic. We're suspicious of the academy. We come back here to get new ways to think about being an activist. And this is why we're here. It's not because we want to become professors. And so I felt very well situated. So that's a long story, but that's the way I decided to answer those three questions. Thank you.
That was a great story to tell and to put in STS history. Why don't we ask you just a couple of follow-ups, imagining how people in our different worlds might have heard the story. And one that I have to start with is, you said that early on you thought that philosophy of science was a place where you would work out some of your puzzles. And tell us why philosophy of science was a beacon at that point, and how you've come to think about philosophy of science in the kind of diverse ecology that your world in STS has become, but more like what does it mean to be interested in philosophy of science at that juncture?
Well, when I was an undergraduate at Berkeley, I lived for a while in a group household in which included some philosophy graduate students. And when we had parties, some of the younger faculty in the philosophy department would show up. And one of them was Paul Feyerabend. And I didn't know who he was, except I realized I was in the philosophy of logic class, but I was beginning to be aware that there was this whole Anglo-American philosophy of logic approach to philosophy, and there were just a few people in the philosophy department who knew about European philosophy. And that in the history department, there was the European philosophy that was being taken seriously. And it was that political theory class I was in, it was the European philosophy and to all the Marxist stuff that was so important. So I was kind of curious. And then I realized that Feyerabend, there was also somebody, a young faculty member, Tom Kuhn at at Berkeley at the time. And he was both of Feyerabend coming out of Wittgenstein and so forth, was requesting the whole idea of method and logic. And obviously Kuhn was situating historical change in science not through because of change in logic, but or change in identification of new problems, but in very different kinds of worlds. So against method and structures of scientific revolutions were very, very important for me in rethinking from logic, realizing also from the nuclear disarmament movement, Russell had been involved in that. And then he had said that mathematics was a beautiful castle built on sand. And I began to think of the whole world of logic as perhaps built on a beautiful castle built on sand. And I thought that Feyerabend and Kuhn had some other ways of thinking through this.
I have two other small follow-ups, but Dorgo, do you have follow-up questions? So two things, Sharon, and in part because I know that they continue to be formative in your current work. You mentioned the Free University Movement, and that's a whole story in itself, and I understand that. But given that it's part of the backstory to your current book project on the neoliberal university, just for people that aren't familiar with the story, just tell us enough to draw them into the really important story of the Free University.
It's a huge story, and I've been disappointed to see that not many people know it these days, so thanks for bringing it up again. It has a very long history that's very important to know. And if I go into all that, it's going to take another hour. So I'll just say it's a very long history all over the world. And it's partly got to do with working class access to complex knowledge making and critical thinking. It's also got to do with a critique of universities and the whole corporate apparatus of universities. But in the 60s in the US, it also had another dimension, which was the engagement of universities in the Cold War. And so there was the anti-war critique was also included a critique of universities and their engagements, including the whole world of so-called area studies in which anthropology was deeply implicated. And as was a lot of history, a lot of language courses, studies, and so forth. So there were a lot of demonstrations on campus about specific departments being engaged in those activities, not only the ones that were more, in retrospect, people are more aware of is the science and engineering departments. So it was a critique of the existing universities, but more positively, was also a place of what seemed to me to be intellectual engagement for the sheer pleasure of it and the sheer excitement of it. And the pleasure and the excitement of reading together, talking together, debating together, reminded me also of the debates in the coffee houses in Berkeley and the ones I had found in New York, where there was just such an intensity and excitement and the pleasure of just grabbing onto ideas and going with it from people. It didn't matter where they worked or it was my imaginary university that seemed to me so important. And what I felt had something to do with the program that I joined at Santa Cruz in the history of consciousness when it was still run as a collective. And I've always I've maintained that naive fantasy about universities and also the sort of childish disappointment that they're not like that. Childish because, I mean, everything says why they're the way that they are. It's not confusing at all. But I still have that hope that at least inside a classroom or inside a discussion or like this, that it can be that kind of excitement again.
We can come back to this at the end of our discussion today, where concern about not just extending or building, but rebuilding university spaces is such important work all over the world. And the way that STS as a community can be kind of creative actors in that, I know is we all three of us are really concerned with. So I think that remembering that history is good for that making of an STS future. So the other question that is adjacent, but comes from a different direction, and I know is such an issue for so many research communities today, is you briefly mentioned government surveillance of researchers and particularly leftist researchers. And just share a little more of that history, because that is the present for so many of our colleagues. And so I think they'd appreciate hearing your experience.
Partly it comes from my roommate in college, who was a red diaper baby. And then her friends, I met the kids she'd grown up with, other red diaper babies who became my friends. And they would joke about their childhoods of having the cops around. And they sort of grew up with these, just surveillance, and how hilarious these people were, because they were seen as so incompetent. But then gradually, as they got older, realizing how much the surveillance had shaped their parents' lives and futures, and in a very sad way. But one of those people that I got to know later, when we were all out and about in the 60s and 70s doing other things, had taken a job in Europe with a US government agency, being a waitress in the coffee shop of this agency. And she had to have a security clearance to be working at the place, but it would take quite a while to go through. And she was just a waitress, so she was always put at the bottom list. And finally, they came back and told her they had to fire her because of her close association with somebody who was on the bad boys list of the US surveillance. It was her father. And during the 60s and all these movements, we knew that there were police all over the place. And we also learned about agent provocateur, that you had to watch out for who was getting too excited and wanting to push things a little bit in the violent direction, because that might be an agent provocateur. So we also learned a whole history of why there's a French term for that. And then also I remember in the late 60s, there was all the phone lines got really wonky, and everybody started saying, well, it's because of surveillance. And so we would make jokes about the poor idiots who had to be listening to our conversations, but we never said anything of substance on the phone. It's part of why we turned back to mimeograph machines, a kind of retrograde technology at the time, so that we weren't talking about certain organizational things on the phone. But there was a lot of violence too, and we had to watch out for that. Violence from the right, from the soft surveillance that might have been from the police. So, and that included friends who were in Chicago for the Democratic Convention and so forth, people that we knew who were badly wounded, whose wounds affected their whole lives. So there was a strong sense of police being a serious problem all through the 60s and 70s, up through. It began to wane after 75 for a while. But it's there's a lot more to say about that. It's a very serious thing. It's not a new problem for sure. And my husband, who was doing the research for his dissertation, was studying the anti-left demonstrations historically in both France and Italy up through Mussolini. And And I was being his research assistant. So I was in the archives too, looking at all these records from the police about all of their infiltrations of the left. So it's got a very long history. Oh, by the way, I should say I'm part of the Cops Off Campus movement at UC LA right now. And it's a nationwide movement. And it's also, of course, got a history for a long time. I should say, too, that when we were in Paris in the late 60s, there were also a lot of students from Mexico who, from the demonstrations around the Olympics in Mexico 68, a lot of students were murdered, and a whole group of them came to Paris. So we were living in a building with a lot of other leftist students from around the world. And some were from North Africa and some were from Mexico, the ones we were closest to.
This is a nice point to shift to the story of the History of Consciousness program and what kind of space it provided you for your work. But first, quickly tell us the story of the emergence of that program. I know it came from the very history you just described to us and meant to be a special space away from some of the badness around you. So just tell the very brief story of the program before you tell us just the incredible intellectual vitality that you were able to draw from it.
Clark Kerr was the president of UC System during a very interesting time when, with the baby boom in the US, they realized, of course, 18 years early, that the population of universities was going to expand massively. And they began planning for the expansion of the University of California system. And they decided to turn some existing teachers' colleges into universities and to turn existing research, agricultural research centers into universities and to start three new universities. Long story goes there. And the three new universities were Irvine, San Diego, and Santa Cruz. And each was to have a different mission of the time. Interesting, worth finding out. And Santa Cruz was going to be an experiment to show that a massive public university system could have in itself an exemplar of this very American phenomena of the small liberal arts college. And that was very near and dear to Clark Kerr's heart. And it's a long story of the liberal arts college in America and why it's supposed to be an American exceptionalist thing. And in the context of recruiting the faculty for what was to be a four-year undergraduate school, the faculty had wanted to have a program where they could carry on some discussion with some graduate students. And there was some debate about it. And it's a philosopher named Hofstadter was very instrumental, apparently. But he was a specialist in some interesting ideas. I'm going to save all that, not go into all that. But he had the whole idea of consciousness in 19th century philosophy, he thought, embraced a very wide array of ideas. And that from the arts and literature through the humanities and the social sciences, that this history of consciousness would be the appropriate title for such an interdisciplinary program, which would be taught primarily through tutorials in the British model of Oxbridge. A few individual students who would be admitted because they had such individual projects that could not have been, ought not to have been pursued within a traditional academic environment of departments and disciplines, that they were adisciplinary. And that these would be kind of intellectual conversation, tutorial conversations. And Clark Kerr was okay with this little amendment to his ideas. So when I got to Santa Cruz, there were about 3,000 undergraduates and probably less than 100 graduate students. And there were a few people in the sciences who had argued that they should have some graduate students, but some of them were on loan from other UC campuses, and some of them were on loan from the universities where the faculty had migrated to UC Santa Cruz from. So by the time I joined the program, it was run as a collective by the graduate students and the associated faculty with whom they had these tutorials. And so we made the decisions about who to admit and so forth. And we were a little amused by all of the applicants who thought that the whole program had to be about either higher consciousness or raised consciousness. But we settled on the idea, we like the idea that everybody's projects needed to have something to do with something that was adisciplinary or could not be conducted within the conventional disciplines as constituted. So in an application, you almost everybody made an argument about why they had tried to do this or would ordinarily do this in a regular university, but there were so many limitations to the disciplines that it had to be done in this particular way and why they wanted to do this tutorial PhD. The tutorial, in fact, was a kind of surface thing because, in fact, it was seminars with a group of us, the faculty interested and the students interested. What did we want to study? And we would make proposals and discuss with each other and reach conclusions and then do it.
Sharon, how long did the shared conceptualization and governing and administration of the program, how long was that sustained? And is it, can you imagine programs with that kind of structure today?
Oh, I can't imagine it today. And I have fantasies about it. And some of us who were associated with this in those days have this fantasy too. And we think digitally and with a free university, we might be able to do it. So in those days, it started to be seriously attacked and by some faculty who were very annoyed by it. And that's a long story, which I will skip, but it's they were very annoyed and we were annoyed by them. And at one point, the president, the chancellor of the university had decided to stop the program. So two of us went to see him and we were sort of delegates. And why was I was one of the delegates? That chancellor named Taylor was a mathematician and he had written a textbook that I had used at Berkeley. And the other person had gone to one of those Seven Sisters liberal arts women's colleges in the Northeast. And my mother had also raised me to be a lady, not that I was particularly interested, but she had tried. And this young woman from Seven Sisters had gotten all the lady training. So anyway, we both showed up in our lady gear and to meet with the president, with the chancellor. And we had a point to make. We said that if he would authorize the hiring of somebody, and if we could get somebody hired who would come into the program to lead it, who was had an international reputation, would he then provide more resources and allow the program to continue? And he was quite intrigued by the idea because we said, in fact, there was an international network of which we were part, and it was heavily, decidedly, emphatically intellectual, and it had we had this very broad, rich webs of relationship around the world, and we could invoke it. And he was surprised and he said yes. And Hayden White was hired as a result of that. And when Hayden, by the time Hayden arrived, we had told him he needed to negotiate heavily to get resources because there were jerks at bay and that he needed to get resources that could not be appropriated into some other territory on campus. And that this ideally would take the form of three new positions. It could be hired immediately. And Jim Clifford and Donna Haraway were two of the people who were hired under that initiative.
We need to come back to this later in building the stories through which we're going to STS program build around the world, which we've had so many discussions about that in recent years. So this is a story that needs to be told and retold. For now, though, turn to the ways that working with Hayden White and others, Gregory Bateson and others in the HISCON community, what were the ideas in play? How did they shape your thinking? How does, you know, at the time you weren't an STS scholar, how did it come together to be, to constitute the kind of STS, pioneering STS scholar that you are today?
Oh, thanks. First of all, before Hayden arrived, various people on campus had connections to other people out and about, this part of the international network. And they said that Bateson was available and that Marcuse was available, for example. And Norman O. Brown was already on campus and he was part of this network. And speaking of the Cold War and the hot war of World War II, there were a group of American academics who had been part of what was called the OSS, later became the CIA, including a lot of intellectuals. And Norman O. Brown had been part of that. And so he was invoking some of his connections. At that time, there was a fixed retirement age still in American academia, which there isn't any longer, point I want to address later. But over 65, you had to be out, but you could be rehired quarter by quarter or semester by semester, it was at the time, as long as you could every semester prove that you weren't, you kept your intellectual capacity. And so Bateson was being hired semester by semester. And others, including Norman O. Brown, was also sometimes teaching with Bateson. And he had also suggested that Marcuse, who had been teaching under the same program at San Diego, be invited to come teach. And sometimes he would bring his teaching assistants with him, who included somebody who later joined the Santa Cruz History of Consciousness, including, well, back to that later. But it was, so on a couple of occasions, the three of them taught together, which was quite a display. Norman O. Brown, Herbert Marcuse, and Gregory Bateson, they'd known each other since they were young guys. And, but they were clearly éminents. We all knew that. And we students, and amongst ourselves, we all agreed that if you were going to work with one of them, you better work with two, because you didn't want to get caught in all that kind of being turned into an apprentice or a follower or a protege, worse. Just better to stay out of all that muck and work with at least two of them, because then they would sort of respect each other's territory and we would all be kind of independent. So it was a lively debate, hard to get a word in edgeways, because again, there were all these mostly assistant professors trying to get a word in edgeways too. So mostly we were having our discussions before and after, we kids, we students. It was another thing, most of us were not maybe a third of us were to come straight from undergraduate, but most of us had been out for about 10 years because there was a kind of critical time period there of 65 to 75, where whether or not you had chosen to be in graduate school or stayed in graduate school was a very intense decision. And we were the cohort that had not done that. But the assistant professors were, had stayed in. So we were of the same age, but in very differently situated. So it was a very, very exciting life. And again, most of the people who were my age mates, who were the graduate students, we had all been activists in various domains. So we were very much strategically trying to think, how does this help us become better activists? And so it was very demanding, lively, turbulent scene in a context in which these elder faculty felt kind of vulnerable because of being hired semester by semester. And some of them, like Bateson, had no benefits. He had no insurance. All kinds of things that it's kind of hard now. Usually younger people think that elder faculty are very situated nicely financially. And it was clearly not the case for them. And a lot of the younger faculty were a little unsure about being at Santa Cruz and what that was could do or for or against their careers. So there was a sense of vulnerability in from multiple positionings that was quite obvious to all of us. And we all talked about it all the time. And I think that that kept, meanwhile, there were a lot of people who were internationally eminent. And so the idea of being an outlier and being very smart and having a lot of people interested in your work seemed normal. And that was also what I encountered at the Mid-Peninsula Free University, MFU, was some very smart people, some of whom could be a janitor and some of whom could be just somebody with this amazing global intellectual network. So all the ranking stuff seemed, at least at that phase of my life, just seemed not very important. And that was a hugely important intellectual environment. So the idea that I wanted to learn, I wanted to use some sociology, I wanted to use some history, I wanted to use some philosophy, did not seem like dabbling or being a dilettante. It meant I had to work harder. So that was the context of not, we were aware that in some other context, it was seen as dabbling, being dilettantes. It didn't, we knew in our cohort, it meant much more work. So that was a very demanding and exciting intellectual environment, a lot of freedom. And later I thought, that's what I thought, because it was a new field, STS and gender studies, I thought these new fields, they have not coalesced into disciplines. It will be like ISKCON for a while. But watching them turn into disciplines has helped me to understand the whole apparatus of universities. And
so Sharon, I know you know this story because you partly taught me, but one of my experiences in graduate school was just kind of head spinning new understanding of underlying structures that produce everyday common sense, what counts as true, what counts as authoritative. And both Hayden White, I'll never forget reading Metahistory and it, my head never stopping spin. It's still a formative text for me. But I also came from a much more intellectually conservative background than you were in at that point. So what in grad school spun your head, or was there any spinning left to do by the time you were actually in graduate school?
Oh, well, Bateson spun my head, it seemed like at least once a week. And was always asking about form, the form of the argument, the form of the practice we were witnessing. And he was curious about the fieldwork that my project, it turned out that the governor of California at the time, Jerry Brown, was interested in Bateson's work. And as governor, he had put Bateson on the UC Regents, that was sort of the board of trustees governing the university. And one of the problems that the Regents was deciding was its governance of the laboratories, including Los Alamos, that had been involved in generating the bombs of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and their continuing involvement in the development of weapons for the Cold War. And so the UC Regents were periodically deciding, should they release the contract that they had taken on during World War II and put those labs in an independent space or keep them in the university? So Bateson was also asking me all about these physicists I knew, some of whom had been in the Manhattan Project. So he was asking me all these probing questions about my work that were coming from a kind of public policy kind of world that I wasn't expecting from him, where I was like, yes, he's Mr. Epistemology. And then also when But he's deeply empirical, I mean, profoundly empirical in his thinking about epistemology. And that I was so accustomed to the philosophers either being interested in logic or this kind of Feyerabend and Kuhn world about a kind of history of ideas changing. And with Bateson, it was New Guinea, Highland New Guinea, and it was deep epistemological questions and animal behavior and public policy. And they all had to be discussed at the same level. And they all had a position in any one of those arguments had to also take place in the others. And I felt radically disoriented in a kind of positive way. It was later I saw those little Daruma dolls, you know, that kind of pivot when you push them. And I just felt like that all the time, like, whew. And I just, and two or three of my other fellow students, we were just overwhelmed by this. But we just talked madly all the time about trying to keep up. And also each of us having these different positionalities. One, Misha Adams was very much involved with the study of deaf communities, and John Salters was working with Native American communities. And it was, and Susan Foster working on the history of choreography. So we're just overwhelmed by all of this, and it was terribly exciting. And then Bateson got sick, and he could no longer sign the papers for us to take classes or for us to proceed with our degrees, and Hayden had just arrived. I was so pissed. And I went in to see Hayden, and I said, I've got a problem, you can solve it. This is what you have to do. And I was just talking like that. I mean, I was so angry that the institution would cut off Bateson like that. And you know, he didn't have health insurance, and it was awful. So Hayden used to talk later about how amused he was by these HISCON students. So he said, so tell me what it is you think you're learning from Bateson. I said, well, think I'm learning. And he said, I'll tell you what. I'll sign off on you continuing to take classes with him. So you take classes with him. I'm signing as if I'm your teacher. And I'm going to sign all the forms. But you have to come here every week and tell me what you learn. I said, okay. Well, that was intense. Because then I also, at one point, somebody said, well, it's a long story, but anyway, we realized people hadn't been signing up enough for Hayden's class because he was new. So some of them, well, we have work to get him hired here. We got to fill up his classes. So we did. And then all of a sudden I start realizing, oh my goodness, this is complicated. It's like, you know, the introduction to meta history. And all these tropes and this going back into European history, back to at least the 12th century. And good grief. So then we all start taking that seriously too and thinking, well, there's this whole other structure and then there's this structure. And then I have to go talk to Hayden every week about, he's asking his kind of questions about Bateson's work. And when I tell Bateson that's the way I got permission, that's the way we all got permission, he said, well, then you have to tell me what he says. So that's the rest of graduate school, is me learning about these two infrastructures. And now I think, okay, so Hayden is just this intellectual history of Europe. And, you know, he's going to connect poetry and symphonies and Marx and Freud and blah. And okay, but then I realized when he was at UCLA and Angela Davis was being fired by the Regents because she was, anyway, there's all these demonstrations and everything, that Hayden's bringing a lawsuit against the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, for coming on campus and violating academic freedom. And the case went all the way to Supreme Court, and Hayden won, which still affects how much the police can do on a campus in the United States. So I'm learning about all that, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I've got all this with Bateson, it's policy, it's ethnography, it's his participation in the Secret Service during World War II. And then I find out Hayden's got all this stuff going too. And also in the midst of all this, you know, I'm becoming a, you know, most of my, as I say, the teachers my age, The young faculty are my age mates, as are my fellow students. So we spent those 10 years, 15 years doing something else and being in the university. We've got kind of weird relations with the people who are our age mates, who are in the academic apparatus, senior to us. And there's also all the class issues involved. Well, I find out Hayden's family's from Appalachia. And when my parents went to California, his parents are going to Detroit to work in the car factories. And he and I start making jokes. You know, one time somebody who was all part of this whole wonderful intellectual community made some remark that was just, to me, just up to here with class privilege. And I just turned and glanced at Hayden and he just winked back at me. And then we both burst out laughing. I thought, thank goodness. So paradoxically, I mean, Bateson coming out of this whole British academic lineage of academia, these sort of aristocracy of the mind, they think of it in Oxbridge, on one side and Hayden White on the other. And Bateson was perfectly at home talking about class privilege. And as a lot of the people I had been around on the left were not so comfortable talking about their own class privilege. So that was very exciting too. And it very strongly affected some of us students who were not from the almighty middle class, much less the upper class.
How do you think that, you know, in many ways, what you studied in graduate school and learned to study more extensively was structures of different kind, forms. How do you, and you know, when I think most graduate students are taught about what STS is, I bet those terms are rarely used. And so tell us how you, but clearly it's been a really very, very productive way for you to approach your historical and cultural studies of the sciences and scientific culture writ large. Just give us a way to think about how the study of structures and learning to be good at the study of structures is good for the production of STS, what's now known as STS knowledge.
Well, I think maybe the bridge there is through Lee Starr's work with infrastructures. But for my cohort, partly in ISCON, one of the topics that we all decided we wanted to investigate was Foucault. So this is 75, 76. His work is partly being translated, but a lot of us knew enough French to wade into it. And then when Hayden arrived, he was very much into French literary theory. But we had read Hayden's work on Foucault when we decided we were interested in interviewing him for the job anyway. So Foucault and Kuhn are right on the cusp of structuralism, right at the sort of the younger people involved in all of that. And so the whole world of Chomsky and Piaget and Levi-Strauss, the structuralists, the prominent structuralists in intellectual life, we were, from our positioning, seeing them as structuralism having something to do with the Cold War. And that's a problematic position even now to say, but it was trying to understand that sort of intellectual heritage of structuralism, plus, for example, Hayden's work on tropes and this long lineage of this structure of argument in European thought. And then saying what is unimaginatively called post-structuralist, what comes after? And so we're also very much caught up at that time in thinking what's before structuralism, what's after, what's going to be after. Now, for STS, I'm trying to make this short. When I was at Santa Cruz and sitting going to the stacks in the science library where the philosophy and history of science stuff was, and I come across this 4S type work. I'm sitting on the floor in the stacks and eventually sitting in a windowsill reading through this stuff and thinking, how does this fit? Where is this? Where does this go? And the whole Bernal Fleck thing, okay, so that's the sort of the Marxist side of British science. And so I'm seeing also that there's this whole science materialism thing, which through the Althusser and the early Marx seems a little wonky to me, but I also know from my own participation in the Science for the People movement that this scientific materialism is a very big deal amongst a lot of scientists. So, and then I began to meet some people when I do go to 4S meetings, like Lotte Ledersdorf, who is also in Science for the People movement. I'm thinking, yes, okay, I know these people. But there was also this whole other world intellectually through the Scottish, you know, the Edinburgh people and the Wittgenstein thing, which annoyed me a little, fascinated and annoyed me a little. And but everybody's struggling, it seems to me, in the ways that my cohort is all struggling at Santa Cruz and then the Mid Peninsula Free University to make sense of all this stuff. And where do we go if we're not going to be structuralists? And where are we going to go if we're not going to be scientific materialists? And so there's a whole crowd out here screaming at us saying, what do you mean you don't want to be scientific materialists? This is the way to be Marxist in the academy. And it's still a very loud noise that way, leading to, I might add, to all the conflict around social texts. It's another topic. It seems to me that at least some of the people, when I was getting involved with STS, were still very much engaged with these debates. I'm going to flash forward now and say, it seems to me that the people who really engage in these kinds of debates now are the international, transnational, let's just leave the word national out and just say translocal, STS, global. I don't know, global world, you know, it's all implicated in so much nonsense, but let's just say translocal. Two words that are occupied differently than transnational, et cetera, that what is an idea? What is its political economy? Who are its agents? What are its effects? It seems that that part of the discussion that entranced me so much is going on with the translocal STS and all of its manifestations. And I know that we are, many of us involved, are the kind of children of imperialism and the children of the imperialists or the children of the colonists or the children of the local elites that benefited from the occupation. We've all got this stuff in our biographies, in our genealogies, and also all kinds of oppression. And there's still too much that's absent in STS. I mean, it's just glaringly obvious what's absent. It's huge. It's sort of a removal. It's more of it's coming in through the translocal STS, intellectually, politically, economically, in terms of some other image of what an intellectual life is too, I think.
Dorgo, did you have a question?
Yeah, I can ask a follow-up question, maybe to open up more about like your intellectual diversity, Sharon. But before getting into this question, I'm really impressed by this story because it resonates very well where we are located right now in Turkey. And this is how STS matters for me, especially in today's context in Turkey as well, when we struggle for academic freedom. So, and we also forget about this story as STS scholars, maybe, you know, like, and this is maybe more, it wouldn't be more timely than today to recall this story. So I really appreciate you telling us these stories in a very, you know, effective way as well. So You mentioned about the SDS and gender studies at the same time, how they were undisciplined in one way. So continuing from there, I also wonder about, you know, for example, like particular feminist SDS scholars that have also shaped my own thinking as well. And I also know that, for example, Sandra Harding, she's a very close colleague and friend of yours. But we also mentioned about the History of Consciousness program, and Donna Haraway also come to my mind, just, you know, among other great thinkers and people. So would you mind saying more about, you know, how, for example, Sandra Harding and Donna Haraway have influenced your journey in SDS or your thinking? And I would really appreciate to hear your favorite things about their thinking that you think, you know, like, this would be also a long story. So quickly, if you can say more on this, I'll appreciate
it. I'll try, because this is, as you know, such a big part of my world, my thinking. I'll add another detail to this is after I finished at history, well, while I was ABD, finishing my dissertation in history of consciousness, I got a job teaching at Stanford. And it was a 3-year teaching appointment. And in the midst of it, there was a chance to apply for a job at MIT, which I did not think, I thought there was no stretch of the imagination I would get it. But I had friends in Boston I wanted to go see, one of whom was this person I got to know my first year at Berkeley as my roommate, who was the red diaper baby. And I thought, oh, I'll get a free trip. If I get on the short list, I get a free trip to Boston. I'll go see my friends. And also somebody from the commune, two people from the commune were then living in Boston. So I said, cool. I'll just get on the short list. And I did. So I felt completely confident going in, because I didn't want anything except the trip. And in that context, somebody at Santa Cruz, long story I'll skip, told me I should get in touch with Evelyn Fox Keller, who was then teaching at Northeastern, but also was an adjunct at MIT, where this job application thing was. And when we hired Donna, Evelyn had been on the short list for the job, along with Margaret Rossiter, three amazing people. And so that was this, getting introduced to the three of them in the context of Santa Cruz. This is my last year, so I'm already teaching at Stanford. By the time Donna shows up, it's my last 6 months at Santa Cruz. So Donna and I are having conversations, but I'm also in conversation. I'd already been offered and accepted the job at MIT. So I was in conversation with Evelyn, and it's amazing. And then I get to MIT, and Evelyn's got this kind of sideways appointment at MIT, and she's got an office in the same section of the same building. And she decides from her base at Northeastern to have a discussion about science and feminism, bring in a bunch of people. And this person is there, shows up, and she walks up to me, and it's in a kind of loud voice, says in front of all sorts of people, this is Sandra Harding, says, well, Sharon Trawick, finally get to meet you. How come you haven't been publishing more of your work? Everything I get from that's from more your, it's just like Sami stuff. That's what, you know, the dissidents in the Soviet Union, we call that Sami stuff. And everybody's turning and looking at me, and I'm like, oh my God, that's Sandra Harding talking to me, and everybody's looking at me. So I felt that way about Donna and Evelyn and Sandra, that they were sort of the elders. This is in the context of when at Santa Cruz, when I try to join the feminist studies group, they say I can't join because I'm studying men. And that means I'm woman identified. And the academy is filled with enough men's studies. We don't need another. And there are a few of us feminists at the edge of academia that we should be using our embodied energy and minds to study women. And so I said, they said, you can stay as long as you agree to only study blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, thanks. So, And then all of a sudden, there's Donna and Evelyn and Sandra and Margaret Rossiter. I mean, and I'm feeling, okay. And I had met Margaret in another context too. She's amazing. So I feel entitled that these four women are doing this amazing work in gender studies and science in a context in which almost everybody else who are feminists in the academy are saying, no, no, you can study all that, but only how women are being exploited and used, which of course was a huge topic. And meanwhile, a lot of women scientists are also saying, well, if you think you're a feminist, how come you aren't studying us? So I just feel so grateful for those four people, just because they're there, not to mention their work. So Donna and Sandra do two things their whole careers that are enormous. All of those people helped me in major ways. Donna engaged in a practice and Sandra engaged in, both continue to engage in practices that had huge effect on me and lots of other people. Donna cites junior people, cites graduate students in her work. This whole citation practice. I heard her at the anniversary event for Catalyst yesterday. She was talking about her citation politics. It's huge that she invokes graduate students and people junior to her, unknown people, in the midst of her work that's being circulated all over the world, which then circulates all of our work. It's huge. Sandra does all these edited volumes in which she brings in all of these people like me. So our work starts to circulate because she's doing it again. So she continues doing it. So it's huge, democratic. The whole, we talked about influence and genealogies. And, you know, academia is rife with all of this kind of, oh, my teachers were and oh, my influence was and so forth. This is a whole different sense of genealogy. It's the relatedness. It's how we're all tied to each other and a connection and sense of responsibility and obligation. It's not just a kind of worship of the elders. And there's a kind of egalitarian engagement with the other ideas and idea makers and also a responsibility to help those coming along that I learned from the two of them quite emphatically, powerfully, amazingly. And it's huge, and ideas. So, Sandra, strong objectivity. Mm-hmm. So she's part of a whole debate about standpoint theory, and it's through her that I learn about standpoint theory and all of the others, because these are all conversations that gets a name of an individual, you know, happens in all of our fields, you know, this eponymous stuff. She's part of a conversation and she brings people in and then redirects us. And standpoint theory is part of that. Strong objectivity, huge. I teach it all the time. What does it mean if we know the subject positioning of the knowledge makers, if we're looking at their ideas? And this takes me back to trying to understand induction, the theories of induction in mathematics and philosophy. And if you understand the situation of the knowledge makers, does this give you some new insight into the knowledge making? Yes, sirree. So that's huge. And all of Sandra's work about sitting at the kitchen table. Can you talk about your ideas at the kitchen table with somebody else? She's deeply involved with that kind of community work. And through all of her work with UNESCO and science education around the world, it's just amazing. And of course, with Donna, I would say it's primate visions for me is really the big deal. And it's, again, it's back to what I was saying earlier about Bateson's work, where primate visions, you know, you've got the policymakers, you've got Teddy Roosevelt, you've got the New York Natural History Museum, if you've ever been to that place. I mean, it's talk about palace of wealth. And how all that is implicated in patriarchy and is patriarchy. And then how you need that to understand primate studies. And you need that to understand the whole sense of masculine authority, and including masculine epistemic authority. which, you know, I'm in the meanwhile, I'm doing all this lab studies while I'm watching all these guys try to learn how to perform masculine authority, not being very good at it as they get started. And also coming from lots of different cultures where the way you perform masculine authority in Paris sure doesn't look like what it's supposed to look like in San Francisco, Palo Alto, or Tokyo, or Tel Aviv. And, you know, in Rio. So, and all of a sudden, all these guys are in the same collaboration trying to perform their masculine authority according to their cultural context. And it gets, you know, it just doesn't, they don't quite understand each other's performance. But Primate Visions helped me to think about how this whole world of performance of masculinity gets laced through all these other worlds of social behavior studies and political economies, inherited wealth, and temples to knowledge, and all the rest of it, is how to lace all of that together. Yesterday in the Catalyst anniversary thing, people were asking her, how come she didn't say more about A, B, and C and Primate Visions? She said it was a 10-year book. Had to perform to the clock. She was at Santa Cruz. She had been denied tenure in an earlier position. Jim had not been able to get academic positions. I like to tell these stories. Sandra also was not in a very secure position. Evelyn certainly wasn't in a secure position. All of these, and Margaret Rossiter wasn't either. All these people are so famous, and they weren't in secure academic positions at all when they got started, taking huge risks. Just because of the passion that they had. And they, you know, to be sure, they weren't totally impoverished. They did have access to some kind of income. So it's not like zero privilege. And, you know, like a lot of people have zero privilege. They had access to a little bit. So I think it's like, nonetheless, it's very, very interesting biographies and stories of their own, about their own achievements of strong objectivity, I would say, or the way, and I'll just say too about each of them. I was a visiting professor at San Diego once when they were getting their SDS program, quasi-SDS program started. And one of them, I'll leave it to the side for Moni, was English. And he listened to Donna give a talk at San Diego and he said, God, she's like a Welsh preacher. And this is in a context where a lot of people in STS were sort of being very snotty about Donna's ideas and work. And anybody who talked about them was called a Haraway clone. So yes, there's a sort of the Welsh preacher element to this kind of passion that all of these people, Hayden and Donna and Gregory Bateson and Sandra Harding and so forth. So that was another, and Vartan Gregorian, we haven't talked about, from West Asia, was just, they're great storytellers and very passionate about their work. So Donna and Sandra continue to emulate that and represent that to me.
Sharon, I know that when you teach these figures, you teach the similarities in their patterns of thought that constitute feminist epistemology as a kind of body of work and space for others of us to work. But you also draw out the differences between them and the different intellectual genealogies that produce these people that are now in community. And explaining all that to us would take forever. But for now, tell us why you think it's important to attend to these diverse genealogies, draw them to the surface, work with them, see them as a resource rather than something to kind of pretend aren't there so that you can be in community based on sameness. I know that you're you really believe in practice the value of difference, and just talk that out for us a little bit.
Well, not to be annoying, I just want to say that there's these sort of coherent programs that make me quite nervous. their coherence, their sameness, their sort of monolithic quality. So I happen to like the ideas and actor network theory a lot, ANT, the ANTS. And I think that the acronym is ANTS is wonderful. But it's also become a kind of monolith. And I've heard people talk about being an ANTS scholar, and good grief, and also being a kind of benefactor and or advocate or originator or whatever of ANTS. Well, whatever it is, I think I'm not interested. It's from all those debates, Berkeley, about who's the right Marx. I just get very, very nervous about anything that starts to seem like a doxology, an orthodoxy. Orthodoxies make me very, very nervous. And I assume, you know, it's partly, it's Marxist. What's been marginalized? What's Derrida? It's Foucault. What's been marginalized in all that orthodoxy? What's been erased in order to make it all the same? Because it isn't the same. And how, it's okay if it's a movement. It's okay if it's a movement where it's, you know, okay, we're all going to be against this particular war, but we don't agree about much else. But for today, we're all going to get together and be against the war. That's okay. That makes sense to me. But to say, anyway, so I think it's important intellectual exercise to see where is the sameness and where there's difference. If we're going to talk only about sameness and otherness, then we're into the world of classifications. It seems to me a fundamental negation of the very originary insight of feminist epistemology is that binaries are a bit odd. And binaries are based on a whole classification system, Linnaeus, all that stuff. You know? There's something wrong with it. And intellectually, conceptually, epistemologically wrong with turning the world into categories instead of a spectrum. And if we want to do it, maybe that's cool. It can be very, very helpful sometimes to have an on and an off switch. But to understand how it's constituted and why, when it's not useful. So that's where I start. And then, yes, Donna's starting out of being, you know, she was a graduate student in biology. Sandra was a graduate student in philosophy of logic. Her dissertation was on that. Donna was very much, as is even later in history of science, in X-ray crystallography. Most of the people I know whose work was very, very important to me were doing something else in grad school, and before they get their first position, then they were jumping the traces to do something different. Well, Sandra and Donna were jumping different traces, just like Evelyn Fox Keller. She was in biophysics. So they're all jumping in different directions with different tools. And I think it's important to understand what they were leaving or what tools they took with them, what they ran away from that other stuff. And what tools did they bring? And then what can they do with these different tools? It seems very, very important to me. If you know that Sandra comes out of all that logic work, you can see it in everything that she does. And if you know that Donna's coming out of the biosciences, Sandra eventually starts looking at the logic of studies of gender in the social sciences. And Donna's doing this with biology. And then of course, Evelyn Fox Keller is looking at biology too. Well, I'm the one looking at the physical sciences. They're not. Almost all feminist science studies is about biological sciences or biomedical technosciences. And so the very few of us working on the physical sciences, and then there's a big other neighborhood of the computer science world. But almost all feminist technoscience is biomedical science. And so I'm still trying to figure out how is that going to be different from what they're doing and how they've done it. Biomedical from Donna and all sorts of other people, important people in feminist epistemology, work huge, almost everybody, I'd say 80% working in biomedical stuff. And Sandra and Helen Mangineau and a group of other people, Allison Wiley on the social sciences. little neighborhood over here in the physical sciences. So we're different too. And so I try to teach the students, if you're going to be thinking about feminist epistemology in your field, it helps you to know about how it's been done differently about the social sciences and the biomedical sciences and a little bit about the physical side. How's it going to be different in your neighborhood? So sameness and difference seems to me to be right at the core of feminist epistemology and a repudiation of the binary presumptions. It means that if you just crawl back into binaries and classifications, you know, you're sort of contradicting yourself at a very, very fundamental basis. It's really quite shocking, in my opinion.
Dorgu, do you want to follow on this?
Yeah, I think like we can ask multiple questions, but I also know we have a limited time. So from there on, Sharon, I just wonder how you think today about SDS as a field of study, you know? So we mentioned a little bit about, you know, your reaction to the disciplined SDS, and you, I think, beautifully elaborated more on this by bringing, you know, multiple thinkers, great thinkers here. So I also wonder, like, what do you see the biggest challenges and obligations of SDS in today's world as a field? And maybe we can also talk a little bit about Forest, because Forest is also becoming a transnational society, and it's our, you know, home in one way or another. So what do you think about Forest as an organization going forward?
Yeah, huge question, and hugely important and urgent. So, and I change my mind daily, but I think some issues appear consistently. So legitimacy, entitlement, resources. So it's good if we can help students to get some funding. It's good if we can get funding for research. It's good if we can get resources to circulate our ideas. And the conventional way that happens is through universities and through the conventional funding sources. And the conventional way to get access to all of that is through a certain kinds of legitimacy, certain kinds of citation practices, certain kinds of licensing, degree granting, et cetera. And yet we are surrounded by work that is not, we think is important, that hasn't been recognized. And in those channels. And so going back to the Mid-Peninsula Free University experience and the early history of consciousness experience, I think being at the edges of a lot of that authority does clearly provide some resources. I get thwarted at UCLA in personal ways and academic ways and professional ways all the time, but I am still employed. And people have trouble getting their degrees approved, but they do get the degrees and so forth in many cases. So I think dealing with being in the margins is how to make that a lively place, to be at the edge intellectually. On the edge is also has all sorts of positive connotations in American English. So being pushed to the edge, but also being at the cutting edge is, how do we do that? And I know that there's a very large tide of people that have been in SDS all along and in 4S all along, who are very big on gaining that kind of privilege and authority. And it's been there a long time, and we could all tell lots of stories about who's done what and so forth. And accrued all of that. In the meantime, their voices change and their posture changes and so forth. It's tedious to watch, but understandable. So how do we create space for an STS that, you know, it's already happening, it's already like that, but also keep the edges alive and active? I think one of the big benefits for us is that it is non-disciplinary. And sometimes it just seems like a branch of sociology. But I've seen it become more than that. So I think that for us to become something that is not disciplined creates a huge opportunity. And there are a few other examples that maybe we could make use of or exploit these other examples. But I think non-disciplining of 4S is, and also its non-nationalization, while understanding that so many resources in academia come through national resources, that it's idiotic to turn them off, to just say never. It's like going into a kind of hermitage. It's possible, but it's harsh. And I think it's better to find ways to make these margins bigger. You know, those, sometimes we pick up a book and the text seems to be the margins seem to be wider than the text. Well, let's go there. Let's do that. How do we do it? I think we learn more about the practices that are already going on about that. That's partly how I study women in astronomy, is who's at the margins, how are they surviving at the margins? Surviving successfully at the margins, to use a phrase from Mia Ong, what are success strategies in the margins? So I think disciplining has all the obvious benefits, and I certainly participated in it in gender studies, and you see it in all ethnic studies, urban studies, all kinds of fields. You can look at it, all these fields to become departmentalized in American universities, institutionalized. It's a way to get access. It's a way to get the courses for the students, to give them degrees for what they've learned. All that's important. I get it. I do it. It's so filled with a kind of disciplining of consciousness too, that many people cheerfully engage in and cheerfully insist that students be disciplined in that way, and all the meanings of discipline and punishment. I've witnessed it all the time. So it's how to create some space at the edge for the people who don't want that. You've got lots of people who do want the other. I think because STS is translocal, operating in multiple different national regimes, and we're all experienced with that. We know how they function and we know where the edges are, that we can keep on doing that. And I understand that there is all kinds of problems with the idea of translocal civil society, but I think we are something like, there's a kind of opportunity there to have the analog of a Peninsula Free University or a kind of history of consciousness program of STS, where we are learning how to function. As somebody said to me once, being a weed in a very fancy garden is a pretty good life. So, and there's all sorts of privilege associated to that. So how could we use that privilege for the people who are the weeds in not such nice gardens? So not even in a garden. So how do we do that? I do think that we know enough about it that we can share that information with each other if we just decided to talk about it.
I have what can be our last question is, you come from a tradition of work where really quite heated debate and deliberation of different genealogies and different ideas you participated in and were very productive for you. And I would like to preserve that culture in its best instantiation within STS, where there is a, it has that kind of intellectual vitality of the Free University of you, as you described it. So Do you have suggestions for people that are building STS spaces like a standing lab in Turkey or an academic program anywhere? How do you see the culture that you've experienced as the kind of culture that exemplifies working in the margins rather than at the center?
Well, one thing I'm thinking of is at one point I was approached by a U.S. government funding officer. He said, "Oh, with these physicists, you're studying discovery in the context of both scarcity and abundance. Tell us which is more effective." I said, "I'm not going to talk to you about that. I mean, first of all, physicists would stop talking to me if I did that. So how do we make the ecologies of scarcity and abundance, the cultures of scarcity and abundance work with us and not hurt us too much?" So yes, I do know how to do this. Yes, I know I make it sound like it's kind of cheerful and fun. Sometimes it's extremely painful, and I have the bruises that go right to the bone. I don't know if you know, if you can fall so much that your bones get bruised. And I feel I have that experience in academia, and it's harsh. It's awful. It's even worse when it happens to somebody that I feel connected to, who has fewer defenses than I have. I feel we're in a very harsh time, obviously, globally, with awful, awful pandemic world, a horrible, precarious world, a racist world. I think maybe the good news in all that is it's so obvious that we are embedded in a deeply racist, classist, ableist, ageist, nationalist, etc. world of infinite classifications upon classifications, all designed to exclude something, to show how smart somebody else is and how entitled they are. Goodness, is it's the good thing again is it's so obvious. It doesn't take a lot of convincing these days to sort of point to and say, "See?" And then to say, "What are the rest of us going to do about it? At least, you know, for today and tomorrow." And I can remember those moments in the 60s when we thought that it's going to take us about 5 years and we'll get this all cleared up. It was a nice feeling. And I see that sometimes in young people now saying, "We'll get this taken care of in about 5 years." And so that energy needs to be there too. I'm not patient. I'm too old to be patient. I want it to happen while I'm still alive. So I'm all for getting it done as fast as possible. And also for finding as clear a space for us to have a good time with all this tomorrow, now, this afternoon. So I don't want us to wait. So I think finding the culture, the spaces, I think paradoxically, I mean, I hate Zoom, but I love being able to communicate. You know, the fact that we're doing this from vast distances and having this conversation is delicious. So, you know, it's like back when we had telephone surveillance and we didn't want to use the phones. Well, then somebody came up with something called black boxes and then blue boxes. Maybe you've heard of them. It wasn't just the phones, the police doing surveillance on the phones. Maybe you know that the Vietnam War was partially financed by a tax that was put on telephone calls. So nobody wanted to use the phones if you wanted to end the war. They certainly didn't want to pay the taxes. So found alternative means of communication. And we can do that. And maybe we could have a virtual history of consciousness program or a virtual, and we've already now learned how to do virtual forest conferences. It's great. And you know, we're patching together virtual seminars with people from all these different schools. So we just get ourselves lined up in our curricular niches on our campuses, and then we get everybody meeting at the same time. just like the way, Kim, you organize the asthma files. It's beautiful. So those cultures of, okay, we get situated in some place, that's okay. We know how to be members of multiple communities at the same time. We know how to be multicultural and learn how to, okay, you know, I know how to go talk with these people. I know how to talk with these people. I know how to act like a lady and talk, you know, algebra textbook or whatever it was. So we've all got our strategies. So I think it's bringing together people who want to do all of that rather than the people who want their orthodoxies. And I keep remembering from the violence and turbulent family I grew up in, and really loving the aesthetic patterns in mathematics and music. And I understand the desire for that kind of certainty, but I also learned it's on sand. So finding these other kinds of cultures where we can do what we're doing. I mean, this is weird because it's just me, but talking and answering your questions, but where we can carry on those discussions. I think we just got to maximize these existing channels. One more thing. I mentioned generation a few times, genealogies and relatedness and connectivity. And there's a whole Southern thing about cousins. I'm kind of turbulent with some of my cousins right now, but anyway, cousins. And generations. So I mentioned before, I went back to school. So academia is like a lot of other, you know, it's very much age graded, as anthropologists would say. So if you know somebody's career stage, you typically know what their age is. And that's how I get treated, to be 15 years younger than I am, because my career stage is 15 years junior to my age. And works for me, works against me. So in grad school, it was kind of interesting because the junior faculty I was meeting were we were age mates, but we had very different career decisions to get to those stages. And it was so weird that some of them couldn't keep in mind that I was the same age they were, the same political economies, historical stuff we'd gone through. I was junior, I was a grad student. So, and similarly, that was something about Hayden and Sandra and Bateson and Vartan Gregorian. They knew that. They didn't forget how old I was. So I could be junior to them and be an age mate, and they were okay with dealing with the complexities of that. Good grief, and often a lot of people can't get it in their heads. And it just exposes so much about their dealings with equality and inequality. It's just that little thing makes, you know, it's trivial if it's about me, but it just exposes so much stuff. And academia and ageism is so powerful in all this. I mentioned my age in a meeting, a gender studies meeting, and afterwards, outside another building waiting for the elevator, somebody who had been at the meeting said, "Sharon, you don't have to tell anybody how old you are, and it's dangerous when you do. Don't do it." She was dying her hair. And I've been told the same thing in Sweden at forest meetings. It's kind of interesting. But it's a kind of interesting test. Every once in a while, we come across these little litmus tests, and you just get exposed to so much information about somebody that they don't think they're revealing. And they cannot deal with their ageism. So it's kind of useful sometimes to just kind of blurt it out and say, "Hey." I've routinely been asked at 4S meetings by people not from the US who don't understand how new jobs are created, "Don't you feel guilty still not retiring?" So guilty for what? I got every 4S meeting I've gone to, for it's face-to-face, I've been asked, why don't I feel guilty? And people from many countries. I said, "You want me to tell you how new jobs are created in America? Maybe you should figure this out because you could use it in your own home country." So anyway, this is back to being in the margins and thinking about Bateson not having a regular job and not having health insurance. So when he was getting really ill, it was the Buddhist who took him in. So I think finding these places at the edge is very important for this culture, for And I think we all know these places. We, in our everyday experientially, we know these places we can go to for some comfort and some stimulation and friendship and love. And we just need to tell each other more about it and use them more, I think. That's the optimistic side of me.
I need to end here, but this has been a super powerful interview, and I think it will be a really wonderful supplement to your lecture, which itself was such a gift to hear and have as part of the kind of body of work that we can teach with going forward.
It's a great gift to me. Thank you so much.
I should have the recording soon, and it will be auto translated, and then we can figure out which form of it we like best and want to work with, but it will be great. So thank you.
Thank you both so much.
Lovely, lovely. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you very much.
Good night, Dorgu.
Good night, everyone. Bye.